Good morning, everyone. We will be finishing this short series that I began last month on the what we call the motto of the order. This is something that, of course, Swami Vivekananda came up with, and it represents really the ideal for the monastic community and devotees both. This idea that we have this twin ideal for one's own liberation and for the welfare of the world. So I want to start with a little bit of a review, go back to set up the whole story as we had it the first time. Last time we met, I spoke about the meaning of the first part of it, for one's own liberation, not manomarsatam. So this time we will concentrate more on this idea of for the welfare of the world. So this is the phrase that Swamiji came up with. I don't know where he got it from. If it's found someplace else, if anybody knows, you can tell me. This Jagadhita, this idea, Bahujanahitaya, Bahujana Sukhaya, Swamiji used to quote quite often with regard to the life of the Buddha. Maybe that was part of it. But in any case, this Atmano Mokshatam, Jagadhitaya Cha, for one's own liberation, for the welfare of the world, this became the twin ideal. We don't look at these two things as two separate things. They work together. And it may look, from a superficial point of view, like they clash a little bit. But what I'll try to show is how each one requires the other. They balance each other, and it gives a very balanced type of spiritual life. The first time that we hear of Swamiji using this phrase was towards the end of April 1897, when he gave the vows of sannyasa, the final monastic vows, to four of the novice monks. And before he gave the vows, he gave a little talk to all of them, preparatory talk before they took their vows. And his disciple, Sharadchandra Chakraborty, was present at the time because he was involved in doing some of the rituals and things. So he recorded Swamiji's words. He wrote them down in his diary. So this is what Swamiji said. The few days before, see what happens before one takes sannyas, one has to perform one's own funeral rites, shraddha ceremony, because one becomes dead to the world, and also because there won't be children to do it, taking monastic vows when one dies. So the future monks perform their own shraddha rites. So this is when this Swami, this Sharadchakraborty, because monks are not allowed to even perform the Shraddha rites, so they get a householder to do it. And he was a Brahmin priest. So anyhow, that's why he was there. So he records Swamiji as saying, remember, the sannyasi is born in the world, atmano mokshartam, jagadhitaya cha, for the salvation of his own soul and for the good and happiness of the many. To sacrifice his life for others, to alleviate the misery of millions rending the air with their cries, to wipe away the tears from the eyes of the widow, to console the heart of the bereaved mother, to provide the ignorant and depressed masses with the ways and means for the struggle for existence, and enable them to stand on their own feet, to preach broadcast the teachings of the scriptures to one and all, without distinction for their material and spiritual welfare, to rouse the sleeping lion of Vedanta in the hearts of all beings by the diffusion of the light of knowledge. For this, the sannyasi is born in the world. So this is the first time we hear about this, but then just a few days after this, on May 1st in 1897, when they had the meeting in Balaram Bose's house and the Ramakrishna Mutton Mission were officially founded, then Swamiji incorporated this, and we find this in the rules for the monks of the order also at the very beginning, that this is the ideal. Now, what could anybody object to with these two ideas, that we're striving for our own liberation and that we're working for the welfare of the world? Well, there are a lot of objections. And if we wanted to nitpick, we can find our own objections. And I also wonder sometimes about the language of this. For one's own liberation, it has a little bit of a selfish ring to it. And what we see, and we saw last time, that Swamiji himself was not very much in favor of people who only care for their own liberation. In fact, sometimes he would say, forget about this mukti idea. Live your life for others, and whatever comes will come. And then the other portion, for the welfare of the world, who can help the world? We see so many times Sri Ramakrishna said that, and Swamiji himself said it. So perhaps it was the language of it. Perhaps it was that the other brother monks did not have the same experiences that Swamiji had, or the same insight, or the same vision that he had. But there were objections for both of these, more for this idea of working for the welfare of the world. And some of his brother monks and others at that very first meeting, they were not very happy about this. Some of them thought that these are Swamiji's own ideas. He went to the West. He got influenced by his time there, that Thakur didn't teach all of these things. So they raised a few objections. I want to read a little portion. It's a little bit long, but a little portion from the biography of Swami Vivekananda that was written by Swami Nikhilananda, because it's a very, very touching scene, and it shows how, despite the fact that some of them didn't fully appreciate this ideal, they had such respect and love and reverence for Swamiji that they were willing to accept things that they otherwise might have questioned. So when the first objections came, and probably it was mostly Swami Yogananda, who raised some objections, then we read this. The Swami at first retorted to his brother with a sort of rough humor. He said, "What do you know? You are an ignorant man. What do you understand of religion? You are only good at praying with folded hands. O Lord, how beautiful is your nose, how sweet are your eyes, and all such nonsense. And you think your salvation is secured, and Sri Ramakrishna will come at the final hour and take you by the hand to the highest heaven. Study, public preaching, and doing humanitarian works are, according to you, maya. Because he said to someone, 'Seek and find God first. Doing good to the world is a presumption.' As if God is such an easy thing to be achieved, as if he is such a fool as to make himself a plaything in the hands of an imbecile." And he started getting, you know, more and more agitated. "You think you have understood Sri Ramakrishna better than myself? You think jnana is dry knowledge to be attained by a desert path, killing out the tenderest faculties of the heart? Your bhakti is sentimental nonsense which makes one impotent. You want to preach Ramakrishna as you have understood him, which is mighty little. Hands off. Who cares for your Ramakrishna? Who cares for your bhakti and mukti? Who cares what your scriptures say? I will go into 1,000 hells cheerfully if I can rouse my countrymen, immersed in tamas, to stand on their own feet and be men, inspired with the spirit of karma yoga. I am not a follower of Ramakrishna or anyone, but of him only, who serves and helps others without caring for his own bhakti and mukti." Then it says, the Swami's voice was choked with emotion. His body shook and his eyes flashed fire. Quickly he went to the next room. A few moments later, some of his brother disciples entered the room and found him absorbed in meditation, tears flowing from his half-closed eyes. After nearly an hour, the Swami got up, washed his face, and joined his spiritual brothers in the drawing room. His features still showed traces of the violent storm through which he had passed, but he had recovered his calmness. He said to them softly, "When a man attains bhakti, his heart and nerves become so soft and delicate that he cannot bear even the touch of a flower. I cannot think or talk of Sri Ramakrishna long without being overwhelmed. So I am always trying to bind myself with the iron chains of jnana, for still my work for my motherland is unfinished, and my message to the world is not fully delivered." So as soon as I find that those feelings of bhakti are trying to come up and sweep me off my feet, I give a hard knock to them and make myself firm and adamant by bringing up austere jnana. Oh, I have work to do. I am a slave of Ramakrishna, who left his work to be done by me and will not give me rest till I have finished it. And oh, how shall I speak of him? Oh, his love for me. He was again about to enter into an ecstatic mood when Swami Yogananda and the others changed the conversation, took him on the roof for a stroll, and tried to divert his mind by small talk. They felt that Vivekananda's inmost soul had been aroused, and they remembered the master saying that the day Naran knew who he was, he would not live in the body. So from that day, the brother disciples did not again criticize the Swami's method, knowing fully well that the master alone was working through him. So anyhow, what were their real objections? Mostly, as I say, to this working for the welfare of the world, that they felt that Sri Ramakrishna did not stress this. And we know, especially when he spoke to the Brahmos and some of the others who were so involved in reform movements and Vidyasagar and others, that he thought that they were involved in that to the detriment of their own spiritual life. And he did talk about first realize God. They all heard these things. Plus, this was very much against the traditional role of the sannyas in India. From the very, very early period of the Buddhist monks, they did some type of social service work, and they had universities and things, but the Shankaracharya order and the later monastic tradition in India kept the monks a little bit aloof. They weren't supposed to mix too much to do anything, especially the Advaita monks, to do anything that would get them involved in society, which was kind of the Maya, which would draw them away from their inner goal and everything. So while the first portion was a little problematic, one's own liberation, it was really the second part that became a little bit more of a challenge for them and for us also. Because it is true that Sri Ramakrishna did say these things. These are very well recorded and sometimes over and over again. So we wonder, where is the balance here? To what extent do we say, well, let me realize God first, and then I'll work for the welfare of others? To what extent do we do them side by side, or we begin with karma yoga and then move to jnana yoga? So these are all, from one point of view, legitimate questions. And to what extent does this go too far? If seeking one's own liberation is considered selfish, then just working for others, does it mean that we're doing it at the expense of our own spiritual life? So all of these questions came about. Plus, a lot of it had to do with giving lectures. Part of it was teaching others. And Sri Ramakrishna said over and over again, who are you to teach others? And unless you get that badge of authority, who will listen to your lectures? So they all knew these things. So these objections, or questions at least, doubts came into their mind. So we find that there was a range. There were some of the Swamiji's brother disciples who easily understood the value of the type of social service work that Swamiji was talking about. There were some who kind of wavered, and there were some who held out. And some of the householder disciples, M, for example, M was so devoted to the words of Sri Ramakrishna that he didn't like any interpretation that seemed to deviate the slightest bit. So he was a holdout, Swami Premananda. But they all came around at the end, and even the ones who had some doubts, as we saw in this reading, they somehow knew that Sri Ramakrishna had transferred his power to Swamiji, had given all the instruction to him, and even that in some very special sense, Ramakrishna was living in Swamiji. After he passed away, that Swamiji was the one holding that ideal and putting his Sri Ramakrishna's teachings really into practice. So we find these objections. We find that the Orthodox monks of other traditions also found this very odd, because some of the social service work was in the form of serving in hospitals and cleaning the bedpans of patients, doing things which was, you know, it was still a caste-ridden society. These were only the outcasts would do such things. There's a well-known story, incident, that took place in Hardwar, or Rishikesh, I don't remember where, when we had Hardwar, where the two of Swamiji's disciples who had gone there, I'll tell the story a little bit later, had taken up the medical work. They were caring for the elderly and sick sadhus there. They were not invited to a feast that was given for all of the monks, all the sadhus, the bhandaras. This is a big thing in India. Some householders, they'll acquire merit by spending a lot of money for a big feast, and they'll invite all the monks, and they'll feed them, and then they'll give them a cloth and some money. And I attended a few of these things. They were fun. They were nice little things. And one, I got a little cloth and a piece of soap. Because we're rich in sadhus. These were people who had nothing. Anyhow. So the head of the most respected monk of that area, the head of it, because there's a kind of a hierarchy there. He is the one who has the main seat there. He looked around and said, where are those two young monks that have been serving everybody? And they all said, well, you know, we didn't really invite them. they do this kind of dirty work. They're kind of like outcasts. Bhangi sadhus, they said. And he said, what? These are the ones who serve you when you're sick, and you won't even invite them to eat with you. He said, unless you invite them, I won't take food here. And they have to have a seat of honor. So they went and quickly found them and invited them and apologized. And they sat next to the head Swami there. And then everyone was satisfied. And that made a big difference. After that, they were accepted much more in that more orthodox monastic community. It's interesting to note, we'll see that Holy Mother, she accepted it from the very beginning. Some of the brother disciples, Swami Akandananda, there were a few, but the Holy Mother, she never questioned it. Her relationship with Swamiji was interesting, that she had a much deeper appreciation of him and the work that he did, and he wouldn't do anything without checking with her first. That if she had the slightest objection to anything, he gave it up. He had tremendous faith in Holy Mother's judgment that way. So, what is the main objection to this for the welfare of the world? So, Sri Ramakrishna, we have the conversation he had with Vidyasagar. He said that the work that he's doing is good, but he doesn't realize. If he knew that gold that was covered within, that then his work would be reduced. So, the main objection was that it diverts the mind from turning within and finding God dwelling within the heart. Second thing is that this world will go on the way it's going on. There'll always be misery and suffering in this world, like the curly tail of a dog. You straighten it, it'll go back. You fix it in one place, something will go wrong in another place. And then next thing was that, as we saw, not suitable for monks, and this goes all the way back to the teachings of Shankaracharya. When we read his commentary on Gita, we find that he's beating this point over and over and over again, that karma and jnana cannot go together. That the only thing that can remove ignorance is knowledge, that karma has its role to play as a preliminary, to purify the heart, and then we give up. And we, in Gita itself, we see this. We have these two different levels. In the beginning, we do this karma. Then we do shama. Then we withdraw and try to find God that way. So all of these things went into that their thinking, that it contradicted this orthodox ideal that seemed to contradict the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, that there was this thought that working for the welfare of the world would bring bondage rather than liberation, that we would get entangled in the world. So here we have a conflict between the two halves of this ideal, that it was based on the idea of the ego, and I am the agent of action, and not on self-surrender, and giving too much reality to this world, which for Advaitins, it's supposed to be a little dreamlike and not so important. So these were all the things that were in the mind of those who objected. Now, if we look carefully at these, we'll find that it seems to be true. We don't find Sri Ramakrishna preaching about that we should work for the welfare of the world. But we find that he spoke very often about compassion, and those who were lacking in compassion, he said, were not even human beings. He said, Manushoi, Manushnoi. They may take the form of a human being, they shouldn't even be considered human beings. So for him, that was the minimum that we should feel for other people. What he didn't want was this idea that we'll change the world, that after we fix up everything, there won't be any more problems. This is the ideal that the reformists seem to have. So a lot of it was against the thinking and teaching of the Brahmo Samaj. And we find that Swamiji emphasized this ideal for a couple of reasons. One is that he saw that the future monks of the order would not come after having achieved that purity of heart. So the old system was you took sannyasa later in life, after experiencing a lot of life and gotten rid of all the desires, and you're really ready to renounce. The young people would come with tremendous energy, and still they would have all of the desires that young people have and everything. So this would be very beneficial for them in their spiritual life, that they would have to practice karma yoga. So he did it for the benefit of the young monks also. But on the other hand, he had that tremendous compassion. When he traveled throughout India and saw so much suffering, he was really moved by that. And he felt that part of his mission in life was to try to remove the suffering of the world, but really what was close at hand to him, the suffering of the poor people from India. So these were some of the objections. It's interesting to see how the different disciples reacted in the different time that it took for them to change their attitude. Swami Premananda, who from the very beginning had an interesting relationship with Swamiji. They loved each other very much. All of the direct disciples did. But somehow Swami Premananda was stuck with the task of having to run Bellarmut. He was the manager in those days. And Swamiji, he didn't care about time and this and that, and if he was giving them some class and it was time for them to go to the shrine, and Swami Premananda tried to get them to, you know, Swamiji, it's time for them to go, he would get a good scolding. So they had a slightly different take on some small things. And this was at one point. Swami Premananda also wasn't so enamored with this idea. He thought that, you know, Thakur really didn't preach this so much and everything. Then, probably around 1918 or something, Swami Premananda had a very serious illness. And he took that time. He was more or less bedridden. You know, people feared that he would die, and he said, I won't die. And they said, why? He said, because when Sri Ramakrishna went to my mother, and his mother was a great devotee, he went to his mother and said, I want your son. And she said, does a mother give a son for nothing? And he said, what do you want in return? And she said, I want the blessing that I'll never live so long to see the death of any of my children. So the Swami Premananda, he knew that. He said, no, I won't die this time. My mother's still living. So he knew that it would not, and it was true. And, but he took that time when he was bedridden to read the complete works of Swamiji, whatever was available in those days. I don't think he knew English very well, whatever was translated into Bengali. And he used to say afterwards that it created a complete revolution in my mind, that he had such a tremendous respect and appreciation for this, especially this karma yoga ideal and this ideal worship of the living God, that afterwards, that's all he spoke about. And there was one incident where, I think in Malda, where he was talking about this ideal of seeing God in others, working for the uplift of the world and everything, and somebody said, "Swamiji, we want to hear about bhakti." And he looked out and he said, "I don't see anyone qualified to hear it." Now, this is interesting because we all think the path of devotion is an easy path, right? It's not so easy. Yeah, it requires also a tremendous purity of heart and tremendous lack of ego and all of those things. But so this Swami Premananda, he used to say after that, "I'm Swamiji's disciple." Of course, he was Thakur's disciple, but just to show his tremendous reverence for Swamiji. So they all came around, you know, in time in their own different ways. Now, all of these objections, can they be refuted? Is there any validity to them? Of course, there's some if we don't understand really what Swamiji had in mind. And as I said before, I also question the language. Working for the welfare of the world, he could have said serving God and others, something like that. That would have been a little easier for people. But in any case, we'll see that Swamiji himself raised many of the same objections in some of his lectures. When we read Karma Yoga, especially, that no one can really help the world, that we're really helping ourselves. We have one lecture like that. I don't like this idea. I'll be very, very honest. And I don't think Swamiji meant it that way. I think he had a reason for saying it. But if the only way we can get somebody to help somebody else is by telling them that you'll benefit by it, then it becomes selfish. Right? Yes? No? Huh? Then it becomes selfish. So, and Swamiji never wanted that. If you had told Swamiji that I went to help somebody and I'm sure I got benefited so much, he'll say, "Well, what about the other person?" Right? So it, to me, we have to try to turn this around a little bit. Should we feel good because we do a little bit of charity or something? It's okay, we feel a little bit good. But would Swamiji, suppose Swamiji went to a soup kitchen once a month and served people, we come back and we think, "Ah, how wonderful that I help people." Well, how would Swamiji feel? He'd be miserable. He'd think, "So much suffering, and I did so little. And day after day, they have to find someone to feed them. And I should feel good because I did such a small little thing." But I know that it's also a blessing for me to be able to do it. So I'll take it that way. Not that we do it for that reason. Shouldn't be our motive for doing it. It has to be a completely selfless motive or we won't get any benefit from it. But ultimately we understand that yes, it has a great power to purify the heart, that unselfishness. If it's a selfish motive, it's not going to do much. If we do it with a real desire to try to help someone else, then of course we'll benefit, and whether we know it or not, we'll benefit from that. So I think that Swamiji said this so that we get rid of that arrogance, that feeling that, yes, I'm helping others. We want to get rid of that pride and that arrogance and this egotistical feeling that I'm doing so much for other people. I'm the one who should be grateful. I'm the one who should be thankful that I've had this opportunity to serve others because it's an act of worship for me. So I think really this is what Swamiji had in mind. And for those who don't do anything, at least inspire them to do a little, to say, "It'll be good for you, try it." And then if we really do it, and we find that, yes, it's the unselfishness that's good for us, not that we're doing it with any type of selfish motive. So If we can do a little bit, just a small thing to help someone else, not that we should come back with there's a warm, fuzzy feeling, how wonderful I am, but even though we may feel sad our contribution is so small, we'll recognize that it was a blessing for us. We'll feel grateful that we've had that opportunity to serve in our own very small way. Last night, somehow it came up, the Ramayana story. And when they had to build a bridge, and you had the big, strong monkeys and bears and other animals with dragging logs and boulders and everything, and you had these little chipmunks and squirrels that they didn't know what could they do to help out. So they rolled on the dirt, and some of the dust and dirt would get into their coat, and they'd go and they'd roll on the bridge, and it would fall into the cracks, and it would help make the bridge a little more sturdy or fill in whatever. Like, this is what we do when we serve other people. They felt good that they contribute, but at the same time, they must have known that the bridge would have been fine without them. But this was a blessing for them to be able to do some type of service. I think this is the idea that Swamiji really wanted to convey. Then Swamiji spoke about this idea that there'll always be misery and happiness, there'll be a balance. And then sometimes he got a little pessimistic and said, no, really there's far more suffering in the world than there is in joy in the world. But is this also a reason why we shouldn't try to help others? Suppose we see someone begging in the street, and somebody says, you're going to give this person one thing, how is that going to solve the problem with there millions of people begging in the street? Will that really help solve the problem? No, it won't help solve the problem, but we're helping one person. We may keep this one person. Should we not help this one person because it's a huge, big problem and we're incapable of doing that? So some of the logic is a little bit wrong. We do what little things that we can with a little humility and a little gratitude and not feeling so wonderful and not with the motive that, well, it's going to help me in my spiritual life. To me, I don't think Swamiji ever meant it in that way. I think that he was trying to get us to understand that the amount of help that we're doing is necessarily limited. And what we get out of it is something very helpful in our spiritual life. Then this idea that this pride and ego will come. The real point of karma yoga is to do it without any ego and without any pride. It should do the opposite. It should eliminate this sense of ego. If we really care for the welfare of others and we don't care for our own personal gain, our own recognition or name and fame or anything like that. And then the other really big point is that Swamiji was the only one of the direct disciples who really was so fast to pick up this idea that if God dwells within all beings, then service to them is worship. And for Swamiji, it was the highest type of worship. He called this worship of the living God. He said, why go and bow before a stone image when the living God is suffering in front of you? Without enough food to eat, if you want to worship that God, then serve that God. So for Swamiji, it wasn't karma. See, karma yoga is meant to help me in my own spiritual life. This is why we perform karma yoga. Swamiji's ideal had nothing to do with that. This is my privilege to worship God, dwelling within other beings. Whether I'm helped by it or not helped by it, that's not the point of the whole thing. This is an opportunity. This is a blessing that I have to be able to do it. I'm not going to turn it into some selfish thing that if I do enough of this, then I'll get a lot of punya or I'll eliminate a lot of karma. Then it spoils it. It spoils the whole thing. Then the other thing, Swamiji may have understood and appreciated this idea that first we purify the heart and then we practice a life of renunciation. There are some verses in Gita that talk about this yoga rudha, those who attain to a state of yoga. There is a certain level that we have to attain to. In order to get there, we have to practice karma yoga because we have to purify the heart. Once we get there, there's a second tier, and that means that we withdraw. That means we practice renunciation. We don't get too involved in the world that way. Swamiji, of course, understood that and appreciated that, but this process of purification can take a whole lifetime, and it doesn't have to be simply preliminary. We can still be practicing our meditation and our discrimination, the path of knowledge, path of devotion, all of these things, while we're doing some type of social service. So Swamiji, this is part of Swami's ideal of integrating the four yogas so that we can have a very strong type of spiritual practice. It's interesting in the Gita that we have this phrase, sarva bhuta hite rata, those who are engaged in the welfare of the world. And the two times that it occurs, it refers to the jnani, not to the karma yogi. So those who really see the divine dwelling within all beings, they'll serve others that way. This was Swamiji's ideal. There was a story, incident, Swami Premeshananda, when he was in the Swargashrama. This is a place in Rishikesh where sadhus can go. There'll be little huts. They can practice meditation. And there was a very well-known sadhu who was a staunch Advaitin. And they used to have these discussions together that Swami Premeshananda would tell about Swamiji's ideal about serving others. And he would say, no, that the sannyasin should think about this aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. So the Swami Premeshananda, he said to him, well, look, we have the artatvamasi, thou art that. It's not simply that Brahman is the essence of me, is myself. If Brahman is the real nature of my being, Brahman is the nature of every other being. If God is dwelling within all beings like that, then serving others is a way of worshiping God. And his sadhu finally had to admit, yes, the logic is correct that way. So we combine the highest wisdom, Advaitic wisdom, even to go so far as Swamiji did, is saying we're serving our own self dwelling within others. We see that same self dwelling within all, but at the very least, we see God dwelling within others. For Sri Ramakrishna, every man he saw was Rama himself, every woman is Sita. Whatever our spiritual attitude is. Then when Swamiji talked about this service, we have different ways of doing it. There's in India, there's some traditional things, something called annadana, that we can serve others by feeding them. We can serve others by teaching. We can give vidya. If someone really is begging food day after day, we give food, that's good. But if we teach a trade, it's better. Then they can be independent and self-sufficient and get a job and everything. And then jnana, dana, if we can give them spiritual wisdom, this is considered the highest. But Swamiji put emphasis on all of them, of course. And in the Ramakrishna order, you will see that we have our dispensaries and things that deal with the body and feed people that with relief work and everything. We have our lectures for knowledge and all of the other spiritual things, all of them. But Swamiji put special emphasis on what's considered the lowest is annadana, because he said, how do you stuff religion down the throats of people who are starving for a slice of bread? He said, give them bread first, feed them first. Let them get back on their feet, give them some dignity, give them some education, and then only religion. So he's very, very practical that way. So for him, this daridra narayana, seeing God in the poor, was a very special thing. God dwells equally within all, but Swami said, let the poor be your gods. Let that be first. Everything to the poor, and whatever is left over, you can give to other people. But the main emphasis should be on that. And there's a beautiful statement that Swamiji made once. He said, I love the poor. God alone knows how much. See, Swamiji grew up, I won't say in the lap of luxury, but he didn't want for anything. He had all the tutors who would teach him everything, horseback riding and music and whatever, and clothes, food, everything. He didn't have to bother about anything. not that it was a palace or you know, tremendous luxury, but a very easy type of life. Then after his father died, he understood what the real meaning of poverty. He had to go shoeless from place to place trying to get a job without any food. And then when he traveled to India, of course, he saw the tremendous poverty there. So he knew firsthand both the life of ease and the tremendous struggles that the poor had to go through in India. Then, of course, this final charge was that, well, they don't work together, these two halves. If we want our own liberation, then why will we get involved in the world? And we've seen how these help each other. And these working for others, whatever selfishness is involved in leading a strictly spiritual life, if there is any, that'll be ameliorated by this idea that we have to think about others also. We haven't reached that state where we're such great yogis that we can go into a cave and realize God that way. Otherwise, if we just forget about other people and just live for ourselves, even our own spiritual life, there is a bit of selfishness in that. So really, if we are interested in achieving our own enlightenment or liberation, to have some type of spiritual growth, then one of the best ways to do it is to practice this selfless service to others. And this is what Swamiji wanted. And even those who aren't interested in a spiritual life, Swamiji had this conviction, and I also think is one of the most beautiful teachings of his, that if we want to be happy in life, we have to be unselfish in life. You know, this he wrote this beautiful letter to one of the Dewans in India that said, this life is short and the vanities of the world are transient, but they alone live who live for others. The rest are more dead than alive. So Swamiji couldn't bear this idea of people leading a selfish type of life, whether they're spiritual or not spiritual. And those who are spiritual, then it's even worse because they should know better. Right? So they work together. If we can live in the world seeing God dwelling within others, how can that hurt our spiritual life? How can that be contradictory to this longing for some higher type of realization? So we see some of the brother disciples, Swami Akandananda, how quickly he picked up this ideal from Swamiji and how much Swamiji loved him. You read the letters that Swamiji wrote back and forth. He wrote one letter to him, and it says, I seem that I love you almost too much. He wrote to Swami Akandananda. It's a very beautiful statement. And the Swami Akandananda, who did both, he also wandered just by himself, practiced very austere spiritual disciplines, went to Tibet, back and forth a few times. But when he found himself in this village, near this Murshidabad area, and there was a tremendous famine, and he saw people starving, children starving around him, then he couldn't bear it, and he made this really the main goal of his life at that time to serve these poor children. There were so many, because the parents would make sure that the children had something to eat rather than them, so the parents died, so there were many orphans left. Hindu and Muslim, both. He didn't make any distinction whatsoever. And he wouldn't take any food unless they had eaten first. He was like a mother to all of them. And he started the first orphanage of our order. He did the first real social service work of the order. And a place, now we have this place in Sargachi there that continues this village work and everything. So we have the example of Swami Akandananda. And then I mentioned before about the two monks, Swami Kalyanananda and Swami Achalananda. Swami Kalyananda was Swamiji's disciple. And Swamiji said to him, look, you see these sadhus in Rishikesh and Hardwar, that area. They get old, they get sick, there's no one to look after them. You go and serve them. Now, Swamiji's disciples, they were extremely bold. Swamiji said one word to them, that was it. They wouldn't question it. In fact, Swami Kalyanananda, we heard that never went back to Belarmath, never went back to Bengal. People would ask, why not go back? He said, Swamiji told me to come here. That was enough. He didn't say that Swamiji forbade me to go back. He just said, no, Swamiji sent me here. So the whole life he spent like that. So he said, can you do something for the ailing monks of Rishikesh and Hardwar? There's no one to look after them. Go and serve them. So he went. He begged food. What did he have? He had nothing. He was a penniless monk. He begged money to rent two rooms in Kankal as a dispensary and as a ward. And he himself lived begging food from door to door. And then his brother disciple, Nishchayananda, not Achalananda, Nishchayananda, who was an ex-military man, also very bold. So the two of them were there together. How many people have gone from Kankal to Rishikesh? You know how long it takes by bus, right? They walked every day in the morning. They would take medicines and things, walk all the way up there in the morning, and serve the sadhus and walk back at night. It's unbelievable. And not just for a day or two. For months and months. And then little by little, they started a little ward. And now there's a huge hospital there. And they do wonderful work. It's not just for the sadhus anymore. It'll be for pilgrims who go there and poor people. And anyone can get very nice treatment there. Pratibha, Sushil, they know because they went and volunteered at this hospital a couple of years ago. It's a wonderful place, huh? Yeah, they can tell you about that. Swamiji had another disciple, Swami Virajanandaji, who, of course, became president of the order. He was the second president of our order after the direct disciples. And he took a little more convincing because he was a real yogi type. He liked to spend long, long hours in meditation. What happened was he joined Bharanagar Math and then came down with, I think, malaria. And he had taken mantra diksha from Holy Mother. And Holy Mother said, no, my child, you go home and let your parents nurse you and get your health back and then come. He was extremely disappointed. He had renounced the world. He didn't want to go home, but Holy Mother told him to. So he did that, and he started spending all of his time doing japa and meditation, even 18 hours a day, and he would repeat his mantra 100,000 times, 120,000, something unbelievable, went on and on and on. But in the beginning, maybe because of that, he liked this type of life. Now, Swamiji told him that, no, you have to do something. And he wanted him to start lecturing, and he didn't want to lecture. He said, who am I to lecture? What, I don't know anything. He said, then go and say that. Tell them I don't know anything. They'll like your humility. But gradually, he understood, and he became a very staunch follower of Swamiji. We read, there's a very beautiful book called Towards the Goal Supreme that Swami Virajananji wrote. He writes, Swamiji, having received hints from Sri Ramakrishna, this is very important. Thakur may not have said all of these things very directly to the others, but he gave hints to it. And of course, we don't know what type of conversations took place between the two of them in private. But he says, Swamiji, having received hints from Sri Ramakrishna as to how this great truth, that is worshiping God and man, could be practically applied in the daily lives of householders and sannyasis without distinction, proclaimed to the world his path of serving all beings by seeing Narayana, by seeing God in them. He insisted that by practice, the Vedanta doctrine of the identity of Jiva and Brahman can be directly perceived. So the second is helping the first. Seeing God in others and serving others is helping us realize our divine nature. Can be directly perceived and applied to the service of man, with the object of teaching mankind that the ideal of one's own salvation and doing good to the world is not only not self-contradictory, but mutually helpful. He established the Ramakrishna Math and mission. Then he writes again, this Nara Narayana worship, that means worship of God and man, instituted by Swamiji is not merely unselfish, unattached karma for the good of others in order to gain purification of one's heart, the very standard idea of karma yoga. So I remember one of our monks saying, no, Swamiji did not teach karma yoga. Karma yoga is just meant for purification of the heart. He was teaching this direct vision of God in others and worshiping God by serving others. So he says, this Nara Narayana worship instituted by Swamiji is not merely unselfish, unattached karma for the good of others in order to gain purification of one's heart, but is entirely a new process of sadhana for the realization of the Paramatman or the highest self through the practice of a wonderful harmony of jnana, yoga, bhakti, and karma. And because it is so, it directly leads to the attainment of mukti. So the second one is leading to the first. For in this path, one has to conceive of God through jnana yoga as one's own self, meditate on God through raja yoga as the self within, be attached to him through bhakti yoga with whole soul devotion, and through karma yoga, serve him with disinterested, desireless actions. So it's not social service to other people. It's the worship of God dwelling within others. Holy Mother had no problem with any of this. She had that deep insight that this was perfectly consistent with Sri Ramakrishna's teachings, even though he made statements that seemed to contradict this a little bit. And she never doubted him. She was present when one of the letters that Swamiji had written to the direct disciples was being read out. Swamiji wrote so many letters back, trying to inspire them to take up this work. They were all busy meditating day and night. So for them, it was an unusual thing. But Holy Mother remarked, Narendra is an instrument in the Master's hand. It is the Master who is working through Naren. What Naren has said is true. In the future, his words will be fulfilled. See, without hesitation. And when he returned to India, she said to him, the Master is always with you. You have many more things to accomplish for the welfare of the world. M was slow, I mentioned that. M was very slow in accepting this ideal, but he happened to be with Holy Mother when they went to Varanasi. This was one of the places where a tremendous amount of social service work was being done. Many of the pilgrimage places we tried to set up places for the poor and hospitals and things. So there was wonderful hospital work going on where the patients were treated as Narayana. You know, once a year they'll even go around, they'll do puja to the patients there. It's a very soul-stirring type of thing to see that the monks are actually looking at these patients there as God in human form. So this was in 1912, and Holy Mother was shown around. It's called the Sevashram, the home of service there. And there was a free hospital and dispensary for the poor. And she was thrilled to see the work that was taking place there. And she remarked, Sri Ramakrishna is ever present in the place, and Mother Lakshmi always casts her benign glance upon it. And she gave a 10-rupee note as a donation. And they keep that there. It's under glass hanging on the wall in a picture frame like that. Then later, one of the monks said to M, who was there, did you hear what Mother said? Mother just told us that the activities of the home of service were service to Sri Ramakrishna himself, because that was her attitude. She saw Thakur dwelling within all beings. And he was tangibly present here. Now what do you say? And then M replied with a laugh, how can I deny it anymore? So this whole ideal of working for the welfare of the world, now we can see that it needs to be expanded. We have to see it in a much deeper light, that it really means serving others as manifestations of God. It means serving with humility, understanding that we're doing very little. But whatever little we do, according to our ability, is helpful, and it's a blessing to us to be able to do that. That we have to do it devoid of pride, devoid of ego, devoid of self-satisfaction, oh, how much I've done to help others, with the feeling of gratitude that we've been given the privilege to serve God dwelling within others, and to understand that this is one of the highest forms of worship, if not the highest form of worship, by serving others, especially the poor, what Swamiji called the living God. So this is Swamiji's ideal. We call it a twin ideal. It's really one ideal. During the time of work, we serve others with all of our being, with all of our love, with all of our devotion, without caring for our own liberation. So at that time, we don't have to think about anything like that, because we serve as a way of worshiping God, as a privilege, not as an act of compassion. Then, at the time of meditation, we strive for God realization, we strive for freedom, we can forget the world at that time. We're sitting in meditation, forget the world exists at all. And we understand that these two things work together, they're not contradictory at all, that this seeing God in others, serving them is the highest type of worship, is a direct means towards attaining that state of purity, which will lead to this state of God realization. And also, if we can attain that, striving for liberation, if we can attain this God realization, then that's the best way to serve the world. Let there be an example of God realized soul in the world. So this is what we call the twin ideal that we can have in life. One, of course, we want to realize something in this lifetime. We don't want to go through this lifetime without having some deeper understanding of the ultimate goal of life. And at the same time, we don't want it to be a selfish thing. We want to see the divine in others. We want to feel the privilege that comes from serving God dwelling within others. So a very beautiful ideal, and not just for monks. This is for anyone who looks upon Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother and Swamiji as their ideal. This is something that can be a guiding principle for all of us. So let us take a few minutes and sit quietly.